You're saying everything was coming from the joint distribution.
Everything, we were, you know. But in that time, they were already organizing a Jewish community, Jewish police. Everything shouldn't be, we shouldn't be bothered by Germans whatsoever. See, we went down in the military government, and we took all from them papers that no Germans, we don't want no Germans should have any authority over us. That's why we had our own Jewish community. They gave us two buildings, the Germans, like it used to be hotels there, and all, everybody moved in that, in those buildings. We had our own kitchen. We, Friday night, we only ate together, and it was more like Hamish, you know. We started to get closer again to organize a family life.
Had you found out about your brother yet?
Yeah.
You knew your brother was alive?
I didn't know. This is another story. This is a big story already. Because my brother, when we were separated in Auschwitz, they took him, you know, when the trains half, they cut it off on the way in, like, it was 100 cattle trains, 50 went in a different area, and 50 in another camp. I came to that camp, and I came out from that cattle car. We supposed to be in barracks, but there was no barracks. It was holes, but they used to hangers from the aeroplane hangers, and we slept on the cement. But this is besides the point. But I went, was three hangers. I went from hangar, every hangar was a few thousand people, and I looked, no brother. And then I found out that on the way, they cut off half, went in another camp, you know. So I figured maybe, you know, he's still alive, but he's in another camp. But I didn't see him till after the war. One, he was with another brother. We were three brothers. The youngest brother, I don't know how, he was built husky. He looked 14, 15, but he was only 12. And they were together. You heard about that ship when they were liberated in Bergen-Belsen, in Hanover. The boat got burned with 10,000 refugees. I forgot the name of that ship. See, they supposed to be, he was liberated on the English zone. See, it was four zones in Germany. The English, French, American, and Russian. He was liberated on the English zone in Bergen-Belsen. So, he was there, but that in Hanover was a port, you know, with all the ships. And they were counting to five to go to those ships, thousands supposed to go on that ship. They supposed to, I don't know, drown him, eliminate him, or to different camps, nobody knows till today. And my brother was with the other brother, and they were counting fives in the line, and he was standing as a sixth. So they grabbed him, and they kicked him, this brother, but he's alive, and sent him all the way to the end. And this brother, the youngest, he was going on that ship, and then a half an hour later, English planes, my brother saw it, that ship is burning. They were bombing. They thought this is Germans, you know. They didn't know this is refugees. Okay? They came down, later they came down, the pilots, and crying. But it was too late already. The damage was done. All the Germans managed, when they were bombing, they were on the, with boats, little boats, whatever they could. They ran away. And this ship, they came down low, was no flag, nothing, and they bombed it, and the whole ship blew it up. And my youngest brother was in that ship. So you can imagine how this brother, him you couldn't interview. No way. I can't even talk to him. A lot of times, you know, we get together in the holidays, I can't talk. He doesn't want to, he starts to cry and he gets hysterical. He can't talk about the war at all. If sometimes I want to ask him, you know, if he knew this guy, he says, Sai, don't mention, I don't want to know. He can't talk about it because he saw it, how the other brother got killed. It was 2 hours. 2 hours before they were liberated. And on the way, the other brother got all of a sudden, he was weak, he couldn't even walk. And he talked them out, he says, you'll see, it's not going to take long. We see what they're bombing and they machine guns and, you know, and aeroplanes. He says, it's going to be an end now. So keep up. So he hold them. He hold them under the arm and almost dragged them, you know. And he pulled them there. And if it's not, wasn't Bashir, it looks like, you know. He went in that ship. And this brother got liberated 2 hours later from the English troops. So the English did it, the Jeff. But that's not the English fault.
Not your brother's fault either.
No. So that's...
Did you ever think about going back home?
Another. To go on home, I knew I don't have nobody there. Secondly, I know my boyfriends, they went back to Poland after the war. Right after the war, if they saw a Jew in a train, in Kielce was a big pogrom after the war from the Polacks. See, the Polish people, they can spot a Jew. They can tell. Because they were raised with that inside anti-Semitism, with that hatred. And they throw out, anytime they saw a Jew in the train, they opened the window while the train was going and throw them out. A lot of Jewish people liberated from the camps got killed after and they came back to Poland. I got two boyfriends. One boyfriend, they got him in, the other disappeared right away to the train and he went back to Germany. When he came back, he told me. See, he had a big, they had a big furniture store before the war. And the business was going good, so they put up a big building. In that building upstairs, all about 3-4 floors was rented, like an income, apartments. And downstairs, over the whole building, they made a big store furniture. So the building was worth a lot of money, a big building. I was a kid that time, you know, they were building it. And when he came back and they saw him, right away they knew he's gonna, that time Russia was controlling, they figured he'll go to the Russian government and he's gonna have to give up that building. You know, that Polak. They got him in and they chopped off his head. That's what the other boyfriend told me. They got him in and chopped off and took him in a place and chopped off his head. He never dead. And he came back, he says, told everybody, don't even go to hell with the houses because they didn't expect anybody to come back. And all of a sudden they see him back and they're gonna have to give up the property. This was there when the Jews moved out, you know, when the Germans left Poland. All the Polish, what they knew, whose Jewish property they got in. And that's all. Russia didn't chase them out. Whoever lives there, you know, it's theirs. But when somebody comes back, he's alive and he reports And he goes to the city hall and says, this house was my father's, you know, I came back to get it back. The Russians would try, you know, to do something, at least to go in with him and try to pay him or, you know, something. This was after the war. So nobody, everybody lost appetite. That's why nobody went back to Poland. Just a few. What they are in Poland now, this is not from the concentration camp, believe me. This is only people, what they were liberated, they were Polish Jews, but they were living during the war in Russia. They came back during assimilation, you know, maybe they married Polish girls, something like that, you know. That's the only reason, because anybody has a little sense. I would never live in Poland, because I was raised there and I know what I went through as a kid. So why would I go after a war what I went through, you know? I wouldn't settle in Poland at all. Even they would give me the biggest houses in the biggest stores, no way. Because I know I wasn't free. I wasn't free till I came to the United States. In 1950. That's the first time I felt a free person between so many nationalities.
Before I ask you about the United States, can I ask a few questions about what we covered already? I noticed you have a number on your arm. You didn't tell me how you got that. When did they
this has happened? This has happened. The number they gave me in Auschwitz after I was shipped from Buna to Monowice, to Auschwitz. In that time, that meant, we didn't know, but the number meant it to live.
You were going to be at work.
Who had a number was picked to work, but that time we didn't know what the number is for. All of a sudden, you know, was a table outside, and you had to stay, give your arm, and they, you know, this number doesn't come out except the skin.
Tattoo.
This was with ink, an ink needle. Well, especially somebody knew how to do that type of work. But you can see how clear, you know, 18-8-37, Auschwitz.
What was going through your head when that was happening? Remember?
We didn't care. It didn't go, you know. I didn't even think. I figure, you know, that something, because the minute I was registered and they asked me what I can do, what kind work I can do, I says, Mahler. And right away they ask me so many questions, what do you do? Because in Europe, painting is not like in this country, see? Here you open up a gallon of paint and a brush and you paint. In Europe, you have to mix your own colors. And you start out from scratch. You buy chalk, comes like flour, you know. And you buy farben, that means the color, the colors, dry colors. And oil, and how much, the amount you learn already from experience, and everything is mixed. You put it everything in a pail, whatever the amount rooms you have to do, you know, and you mix your own paint. And when you pass, I didn't know that time, but I answered all the questions, you know. He told me, what do you do when you come in a room painting? So I told him, I wash the walls with soap, powder soap, you know, with a sponge, you wash off everything, and the next day you come back and you mix, start mixing whatever the people pick, you know, what color. So I passed the exam, and that led me right away that I'm gonna work painting. I had a suspicion, but still the fear inside, I still had the fear of Auschwitz, you know.
Were there any, in your barracks, were there any Muslims, any that you said were finished, you could tell they were finished?
A lot of them.
Were there suicide?
No.
No offenses?
No. A few guys during the time I was in Monowitz, a few guys I hear that they caught him, they ran away. They ran away. I don't know how. Certain head Japs, they took him like the flag commando. The flag commando had the anti-air gun aircrafts. They picked a lot of times from our camp people in the morning, you know, anthrox, and took him to Krakow, whatever. A few guys ran away, and they caught him. And when they caught him, they brought him back to our camp. And when we marched in, we had an order not to go in the barracks. We had to go on the Appellplatz first, and this got already scared. The minute any congregated, you know, we knew they're gonna pick or do something. So everybody said, oh, who knows what's gonna happen? Appellplatz, you know, we just came back from work, what happened? The minute we came on an Appellplatz, we saw already then we knew right away that they gonna show. And right away they on the microphones they were announcing that the reason all the workers got to go through the ghetto and see, because a few guys, you know, ran away, and that we caught them. And that's the reason, you know, we're going to hang him. That's exactly what happened. So everybody had to go through marching and look the way on the... This was the law, the order. We have to pass by and look at the gallon. That night was hung about four guys. And they caught him.
Did anyone talk about it?
Who?
Anyone in the barracks? No.
We talked about it. We said that you see what happened if you run away. Where's to run? There is no way. We are shaved. No Germans would take you in. The only chance, if you could reach a deep forest and get away with it and get into the Polish underground, but later on, I found out that the Polish underground didn't act good. If somebody came already, they were talking against the Jews, and you were humiliated, and especially when girls. One guy from my city, he lives in Toronto now. Adrian Wilczek is his name. He was liberated. And he ran away from Starachowice. He was in the Jewish police. So he talked to that guard during the day. Probably gave him money too, you know. He had money. Because those police, what they worked, all the transports came, and they were in the places where they got, let's see, undressed, but at clothing, some of them had a piece of gold, some of them had a few dollars, sew it in, you know. And the police had the authority to go in that, they called it Bekleidungskammer, warehouses, see, and they knew where to look for it. So he had a few dollars, probably, and he gave the guard, and the guard gave him a gun. He ran away with a gun. I didn't know then, but I talked to him already, you know, a few times. I was in Canada. We grew up together. And I knew that morning, he ran away the morning when we supposed to be evacuated from that camp, from Starachowice to go to Auschwitz. A few hours before, he ran away. I remember like now, he took off that he was in uniform, but he was going a policeman's hat, you know. He took off the hat, he threw it by the gate, you know, and he jumped the gate and jumped the other side, and the forest wasn't too far. But the guard knew him, you know, the guard was paid off. He let him go, and since then we didn't hear anything about him. But after the war in Germany, I found out that he was all the time, he was a tall guy, looked in the underground, they didn't know, he had a Polish name. Wilczek is a Wilk is not a German shepherd, but what do you call those animals? They look like German shepherds.
Dog?
A dog, yeah.
Not a wolf.
A wolf. Exactly. So, he didn't look Jewish at all. He was blonde, you know, he didn't look at you. So, when he saw a lot of people came to that forest, and he got them connected, but they were always, they didn't know the main gang of the underground, the leader, didn't know that Adrian, that Abraham was his name, Abe, you know, Abraham, and they didn't know he's Jewish at all, so he played his Polak, you know, spoke perfect Polish, and he told me, he says, it was terrible, the way they were talking against Jews, and he says, me as a Jew, and listen, and not to fight back because I couldn't, otherwise I would be killed, he says, I want to save my life too. They took the Jewish girls, and they almost like, they raped them.
The partisans?
The partisans. No? And afterwards, he says, after they raped him, they were talking about him, you know, bad, on top of it. So, he was very bitter after the war, terrible. So he, after he got out, you know, from Poland, he came to Germany, and from Germany he emigrated. He had an uncle in Canada, got contact with him, and he took him down.
When you were in the camp in Manowitz or Buna, were you punished ever for anything?
No, I can't say. Over there, punishment, there is no punishment, or they kill you, you know, when you commit something to be real punished. It wasn't just to give you a slap and forget about it. If you commit something, if they catch you with something, you know, then you complete eliminate it. But the only experience I had is in Lublin, you know, with the electric shock.
Do you remember?
Otherwise, it's beating, you know, kicking.
This happened to you.
It's happened to me a lot of times. You know, on the jobs. One time. This wasn't Starachowice yet, you know. One Polish person, he lived in our street. It just happened he was in the factory, he had a job as a, they call it Meister, but engineer, by the ovens, you know, by the foundries. So a lot of times in the morning, you know, he couldn't talk to me. But he knew me and I knew him. And when he was standing, he came in the morning, he went to the oven, but the ovens was warm, he was standing, it wasn't time yet for him to start, let's see. So he was standing and, you know, warm himself. And I knew already. Anytime he was by that oven, he had a sandwich, piece of bread. And he was standing, you know, and I went behind, you know, by the oven and looked for something, and I took it from him, and no talk, because you don't know who was a German civilian, you know, Volksdeutsch, you know, was a lot of Germans that had swastikas, and and a lot of bad experience I had when I worked in that foundry. At night, we had he must have been half German, but he spoke to us everything in Polish. But he was like a foreman. He took us out. We worked night shifts. He took us out, and we had to load big bars of steel and bring him in the factory and cut them in big pieces. This was shells, 150 millimeter shells, anti-aircraft shells, big. We had to, from a big, with a crane, the crane was going on, what do you call? When it comes to close to the iron, it catches a magnet, a heavy magnet. You can imagine a magnet picked up a long bar like this beam, exactly. Those beams were piled up outside in wintertime cold. We had to, from piles, this was heavy that nobody, we had to with iron sticks to roll them down on 2x4s on a little wagon. The wagon was on tracks, and with the tracks we had to push it in the factory inside, unload them straight by the foundry. And by the foundry was a machine. The machine was going like a press machine. We had to, it was like a table with rollers, and we had to pick up those bars and put them on that table, and with iron stick, little by little, to push it underneath. And we had to, the foreman was marking with crayon, and we had to exactly cut them. And if you had that, if you made a little mistake and cut it a little crooked, this was the end. This was sabotage they took you for. So we were not used. Killed. There was no way. So I was standing by that press, and the whole mine, you know, was controlling, and the other guys, just if I would make, you know, any little mistake, cut a little crooked, this was bars, you know, bars like gold that time. They were anxious to what more, because they're supposed to start with England the war, you know, start with Russia the war. They needed material. They had labor, but no material. And we worked by that oven, and this, we were kicked outside. We were working with so much fear that it's unbelievable. He was a maniac. This guy was a maniac. Just for a little nut, he could kick you in the groin. He kicked guys that fell down, and they fainted. I've never seen an animal. And we couldn't do nothing about it, because what are you going to do? There was all Ukrainian guards watching, and he was so mean, he was so pale. I'll never forget that face. A short guy, but...
Polish? Is he Polish?
Polish.
Civilian?
Civilian clothes. He had the authority on Jews.
Do you remember anybody in the Buna plants? Any of the names of people who were supervisors? I remember somebody named Ambrose, Otto Ambrose. Or Schitzler, my name is Schitzler. You remember any of the German overseers, the civilian engineers?
We were so, who cared about that time? I knew the name, you know.
Faces you.
Yeah, a Polish guy, his name was Otto, blunt Polish fella. He wasn't too bad. He didn't beat us. He was yelling. He pretended, you know, for the authority, for the Germans, that he is tough, but he wasn't that bad. A Polish guy. He was redhead. His first name was Otto.
Was there any disease in the camps?
Yeah, I went through in Starachowice. I had typhoid. The whole camp. Listen, that time, a lot of people died. There was no way to survive under those conditions. I had about 104, that's what they told me, 104, 105 fever. I didn't talk normal. And that, you know.
Are you delirious?
In that night.
It doesn't smell good in here.
Yeah. This is not a story for, so, what were you talking about?
Fever.
Yeah. That night, I was already a few days, but the Sturm Bandführer, they call it the Lagerführer, from that particular camp. He, once in 2 weeks he came, but when he came, he was built up with that beast in him. He had to kill. He had to shoot somebody. So he knew that camp has typhoids. He knew. That's why he came. He wants to shoot anybody in the barracks. So the Jewish police had a report that he's coming. And he came. They took us all out outside with that fever. And he was standing outside, and he ran in every barrack. And who couldn't get out, this was his pleasure, to shoot him on the bed, on the bunk bed.
The Jewish police were well liked?
The Jewish police, very few worked with the Germans. Very few, because they had a lot of responsibility. They gave them all the authority, and they picked up every report, everything from the Jewish police. They had to keep it up, you know. But nobody, they didn't just kick or beat somebody for nothing. It has to be something he answered back, or he, you know, for a reason. But they did their job.
So they weren't hated?
No. Certain police, they were in uniform, they acted that they are already, they're gonna live through, you know, but they killed a lot of Jewish police, but on the end, the Germans. Even they worked with the Germans together, but when the Germans saw they don't need anymore the Jewish police, and when all the Jews are sent away to the camps, they kill the Jewish police. There shouldn't be no witnesses, you know. This was the whole thing about no survivors should be left to tell this story. This was Hitler's idea. But he didn't succeed. He almost did, you know, he did. 6 million.
Let me ask you just a few more questions.
Yeah.
Why, after all this time, maybe you must have thought about it, why do you think that you did survive?
Why? First, it takes a lot of willpower to live too. This is the major thing. The willpower for survival. If you talk to yourself and you say, I got to survive. I'm not going to lay down and die, you know. Whatever's going to happen, I got to fight through, and the end is coming, you know. But it took 5 years. But most of them didn't think that way. Most of them says, I can't live under those conditions and go on, you know. It's better to die one time, and that's it. But not every day to go through pain.
You thought this way from minute to minute, you think?
Yeah. all the time by any, see, at work and going home, I mean back to the barracks, and my mind was that it's got to end. It can't go on. Somebody in the world, you know, is still gonna wake up, you know, because it can't be that one person like Hitler, that one nation is gonna destroy, you know, people just like that, and nobody is gonna mix in. But the minute we saw bombings, the raids, we knew that still the world is, something is gonna happen. And that's what kept me to be, you know, alive today.
You kept saying it was a miracle that you...
Yeah, every day was a miracle. Every day. It was a miracle how, even today, I don't know how I survived and came out after 5 years under those conditions. Because I can tell you on the tape everything, you know. It's impossible. Otherwise, I would have to stay maybe a whole year from the beginning. I just picked up, you know, from the beginning till now.
Have you ever talked to anybody about it all?
Not, we talk, but not as, you know, I talk to you now.
Your family, do they know the stories that you...
My kids?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You've talked to them about it?
They know everything, where I was, what I went through. If I can, you know, kids, they got to know. I got three boys, special, you know. They got to know, and they know.
That just, when I want to sort of finish the story. You were, it was 1946. You were still with the Chinese cook.
Yeah.
The Third Army. What happened then after this?
Then in 1947, then I told you they formed a Jewish community, you know. So I was chief of the, we had our own Jewish community and our own police. I was chief of the police till I came to this country.
What made you decide to come to the United States?
The United States. I thought about the police. I was voted from the all the Jewish people. They voted me, and you know, it was votes. And to come to the United States, I could go to Canada too. But when I worked for the American troops, that's what made me, you know. I talked to the people and to the soldiers, you know, and I had that desire, you know, to go to the United States.
Your brother too?
Yeah, no, my brother was in Israel, and he was in the Israeli war, and then it was very bad for him, you know, right after the war, and he went to Canada, and from Canada I brought him over here.
How did you get together, you and your brother?
After the war? See, that's another long story. See, it's too long. I can't, but I'm going to tell you how, you know. After the war was like, whatever was liberated, a lot of people were, I told you about four zones, each was in different zones, in the English zone, American zones, the Russian zones, and the French zone. He was in the English zone. He was liberated there, and he was there in a camp. Now, a girl was looking for her brother, and I saw this girl in that city, in Bavaria. And we talked about it, and she was going, she had a permit from General Eisenhower. The permit was every GI she should get, and every military government she should get support. Traveling, place where to stay in each city, you know. And she, that's what she devoted. She was looking for her brother. In the same token, she was looking for my brother. So she got in touch. She found her brother in the English zone, the same place where my brother was. And And then they talked, she told him where I am. And right away he took, at that time was no transportation, he took a train, transport train, it's coal, they came, became black, you know, on top of the coal, and he came to Bavaria from the English zone, because that time was bombed, you know, it was the regular trains, passenger trains didn't go yet. So, and that's what I found.
But he wanted to go to Israel.
Actually, we both supposed to be go. We both were registered, you know, but I was engaged. It's another long story. And then, you know, he went by himself and I was still left in Germany. And then he wrote a letter that it's very bad now, and if I could emigrate, if I got a chance to go to the United States, go. Maybe, he said, I can get out. And that's what exactly happened.
You were engaged in Bavaria?
Yeah. To the mind, it's my wife, and they came from Poland too. And, you know,
is your wife a survivor? Your wife's not.
She wasn't in a concentration camp, but she had it worse than me. She was hidden 3.5 years by two Catholic nuns, her and my mother-in-law.
That's another story.
Can't talk about it. She had it worse. Because he was 7 or 8 years old, couldn't upstairs live. German police, mounted police, you know, on a horse. And downstairs, the two nuns went away every day to the church. And upstairs, the woman, the police wife, knew that nobody's downstairs. They were under a table, 3.5 years. Underneath the table, and when they had to cough, everything was in a pool, because up till the two nuns came home in the evening, they could breathe, but a whole day they couldn't. They couldn't even stand up and walk, because Europe is not built like this with brick. It's thin. You can hear every word somebody says. Downstairs or upstairs. So she doesn't want to talk about it.
You came to the United States in 1950. You became a citizen 5 years later?
Yeah.
Do you move right to Detroit?
First step from New York, you know, from this ship to Detroit.
Right.
Until
just,
now.
Just a couple more things. Does the experience during the war ever interfere during the day? Are there times when you see something that reminds you of something in one of the camps or
only
your family?
Only German shepherds. The family, you're always going to miss. See, this is always is in front by any gathering or by any festival, like the holidays, the parents are always in my mind. Listen, it's a part, I was too young, you know. And you are the parents till about 20, 22, 23, then you go away, you come back, it's different. But if you get separated, which we were very close,